Okay, Shlishi Av Va'era is a few psukim long, but we can see some of the themes of these parashios encapsulated in these psukim. They begin continuing a conversation here with Hashem and Moshe. Va'yadaber Hashem al Moshe lemor, ani Hashem, daber al paro melech Mitzrayim, eis kol asher ani dover elecha. So in terms of it being a continuation, so that's the way Rashi understands that this is the same that the Parsha had begun with. But because there was an interruption in the previous Aliyah talking about all of the Yichus, so now we have to re-establish the context that this is this same interaction. However, the Ramban says there's actually a different stage here, that first HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given him this mission, the shlichus, and then Moshe objects in the middle that ani aral sfasayim, ani aral sfasayim, that I'm not somebody who is capable of elocuting, of conveying a verbal message, and this is going to be a problem. And that's where Kadosh Baruch Hu then tells him about Aaron, and then the assumption was that maybe Aaron would do all the talking, so God is telling Moshe that you're still going to do the main talking. And that's what the pasuk is coming here to actually establish. And it goes on to say that you're going to say, Es kol asher ani dover elecha. And it emphasizes here that this is a reference to the actual content. And the Shechina is going to be expressed through Moshe's throat. So you don't have to worry that you're not going to come across clearly. And then Aaron, it could be his job to expand on what's being said. The next pasuk, which really brings in for Aaliyah here, this phrase, Aral Sfasayim, is a theme that we find here a few times, something we need to try to clarify. So we'll take this opportunity through the prism of this Aaliyah to address it a little bit. Pasuk tells us, "Vayomer Moshe fnei Hashem, hein ani aral sfasayim, ve'eich yishma elei farum." So here, I am somebody who is very difficult for me to talk, and how could it be that Paro is going to be able to be receptive to what I have to say? So just to say a word, first of all, about the notion, about the providence here, that Moshe indeed was a Oral Sfasayim, Kvad Peg, Kvad Lashon, language of Oral Sfasayim, as Rishonim explained, it means that there's, just like an Orla, there's something that shouldn't be there, there's something that was interrupting his ability to articulate clearly, and he couldn't speak in a way that was easily understood. So why should it be that this is the characteristic of God's great Navi, of God's great messenger? So there is a often quoted statement of the Ran. The Ran in his drushas explained that it's so necessary that the Jewish people in particular should be able to appreciate that what Moshe was saying was emes, and that he's not bamboozling them. He's not just a smooth talker who's able to speak in a way that's going to win people over, regardless of whether he actually has substance and truth. So therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu selected a shliach who would not have such an impression. You wouldn't think that he's just able to wow people with his speech, and it would be clear there shouldn't be a taina later that they were just taken in by him, but they should appreciate that what he had to convey was actual truth. Zach, question?
I saw a similar point, as in why does it emphasize Moshe's lack of words? And I think it's in the Tanakhuma that basically talks about how, you know, here in Shemot it says Lo Ishtiv Arim Anochi, and then, well, there's a whole sefer of Chumash that's Ela, you know, Hadivarim Ashoti Be'er Moshe, and sort of this is an aspect of character development that we can see in Moshe.
The character development, how that
he turns from somebody who's Aral Sfasayim and Ishtiv Arim into, well, there's a whole book of Tanakh that's just him speaking his speech in the
way. Ah, okay. It's also noted the Ramban in that context notes that Moshe Rabbeinu never asked never davened for Kadosh Baruch Hu to fix this issue, that he should be able to speak more clearly, and therefore that wasn't addressed directly. That's how the Ramban understands it. And as the later Sfarim emphasize, you see here the great modesty of Moshe Rabbeinu. This was all because he didn't want to be sent on this mission, and so he would rather endure this situation rather than have it be repaired and have him be a more apparent candidate for this job. He didn't want to be the shliach. He didn't feel that he was worthy, so to be able to point to this specific aspect of him having an issue with his articulation, that would save him from having to be front and center in this mission. So that's a little bit of background about the notion of Orel Svasayin, but it's come up also, comes up a few times here. So to refer back to the first Aliyah that we read this morning, so the Pasuk phrases it by Dabar Moshe Lefnei Hashem Limora, Hein B'nei Yisrael Lo Shemu Elai, Ve'ech Yishmeini Faro V'ani Orel Svasayin. So here he phrases it as a kal v'chomer, and Rashi tells us, quoting a medrash, "Ze'echad mi'asara kal v'chomer shebetorah." That there are 10 such instances in the Torah where there is a kal v'chomer being utilized, and this is one of them. That Moshe is saying that if the Jews don't listen to me, how could I expect that Paro is going to listen to me? So what's the nature of the kal v'chomer? Ibn Ezra writes that the Jews are your people. You would think that they should believe in you. Of course, it's a little bit of a stira to what we discussed in last week's parashas here, where we noted that Dawson and Avira, when they objected to Moshe trying to calm them down, so there were many of the Farshim highlighted the fact that the Jews especially have a harder time listening to a Jewish person trying to help them out. But okay, here Ibn Ezra assumes that if the Jews are not going to listen to their own leader, so then how could he expect that Paro would listen? Others have a little bit of a different spin on it. Hadar Zakenim emphasizes that the Jews, you would think they would want to believe this, that for them it would be good news. Right? So if we're going to tell both the Jews and Paro that the slavery relationship is going to end, so for the Jews, that's what they're plotting to hear. And for Paro, it's going to be bad news. So if even the Jews, who are waiting to hear this, they're not receptive, so how can I expect that Paro is going to be receptive? And the Ramban understands it, that this is a part of Moshe's objection here. He's saying that you didn't help me out getting the Jews to believe me, so how can I expect that Paro is going to believe me? So part of the issue here in these different interpretations is this kal v'chomer could then exist without the ani arel svasayim. The arel svasayim might be a separate claim. That he's saying is two things. One's kal v'chomer, that if the Jews don't listen to me, so Paro is not going to listen to me either. And also I have this issue that I have problems speaking. But the nature of the kal v'chomer may stand on its own, but it may also fall on its own. A number of the Mefarshim point out that this seems to be a refuted kal v'chomer. It seems to be there's a pircha to this kal v'chomer, because in that same first Aliyah that we read this morning, the Pasuk says that the Jews had a special reason for not listening. That lo shamu al Moshe mikotzer ruach m'avod akasha. They didn't listen because they were very exasperated. They were very worn out from all their work. So they were in a different position. So it could be they were just so demoralized and beaten down, so they're the ones who didn't listen to Moshe, but that's not necessarily applicable to Paro. So where's the kal v'chomer from that perspective? Maybe that's doesn't really allow for that kal v'chomer to play out that way. So here the Mefarshim addressed this question, the Das Kanan and the Chizkuni. They write that that statement about the Jews being so worn out and tired, so that is the Torah defending them, but it doesn't mean that Moshe knew that. So Moshe wasn't working off of that premise. And the Sam Derech, or Simchus Lebrei, adds that this is also a reflection of Moshe's anivus, that he was blaming himself. He was assuming, okay, if they're not listening, it must be my fault. It must be that I'm not able to get the message across clearly, even though there really was another reason. Rabbi Yosef Zvi Dushinsky has a a number of approaches to this question, and one of his approaches, he builds on this Ran that we mentioned a few minutes ago, that the point of his Aral Svasayim here is assuming that it is related, was so that the Jews should understand that what he was saying was MS, he wasn't just bamboozling them, and it didn't work even for them. So if it didn't work for them, so when he's going to go to the king, he needs chashivas, he needs a person who can really talk in a fancy way. So this was supposed to help him with the Jews, didn't help him with them, so for sure, he's not going to have a chance with Paro. He also suggests that maybe the language of Haim is to represent the chashuvim, to say that not only the Jews who were exhausted and who were enslaved, but even those who weren't enslaved, like the Levium, or those who were not so downtrodden, they also didn't believe Moshe. So if they didn't believe Moshe, so then it's a question, how could you assume that Paro was going to believe? Another suggestion he has is that Moshe, and this was also a reflection of his anivus, he thought that the only koach that he has here, the only ability that he has to win anyone over, is the koach of the rabbin. And if the rabbin aren't working with him, they're not believing him, so then he's not going to have any success with Paro either. And the Sefer Paneach Raza, he also adds that he thinks that Moshe wasn't necessarily arguing for himself. He was saying that that's what Paro is going to say. Paro is going to say, you want me to listen to you? Your own people don't listen to you. You weren't able to win over the Jews. You think you can win over me? How does that make sense? Okay, so in any event, then the Saliyah continues with Perek Zion. It says, V'yomer Hashem Moshe, Re'eg Nesaticha Elohim L'Paro, V'Aron Achicha Yenevi'ach. So this language, I guess we should pronounce it as Chol, Elohim. So here, but it's part of what we have to explain here a little bit, that God says to Moshe, so I have made you and Elohim to Paro, and Aaron will be your Navi. So what does that word mean? It's very striking. So Rashi and number of the Rishonim understand that it's a language of authority, as we find in other contexts, and it's a way of saying that you are going to essentially lord it over Paro. You will be somebody who has authority over him. And others have extra spin, that's the Kingdom notes, the Medrash like this also, that maybe it's specifically to respond and to evoke somewhat of the divine imagery that Paro made himself into a god, so you are going to end up being a Elohim over him. So that imagery is particularly forceful. And the Rashiv of Karen Biadner of Goldwicht has a long essay about this in the Sefer HaSufas Marachos, where he develops this idea further. And the notion of specifically contrasting a Kadosh Baruch Hu and Moshe, his emissary, and specifically Moshe being able to have this title, which is God's title, and it's being used by Moshe. So Medrash comments, you see how different the divine king is than a human king. A human king, anyone tries to take his name, they'd get killed. And here, God is essentially bestowing his name upon Moshe, specifically in the confrontation with Paro, who has already arrogated the status of divinity to himself, and there's a contrast being drawn between them. So here the Medrash also notes, as Rashiv expanded, that Kadosh Baruch Hu was referred to in Tehillim as a Melech HaKavod, so the king of honor. So you would think that that means that he gets the most kavod, he gets the most honor. But the Medrash actually suggests that it means that how do you see that God is the Melech HaKavod? Because he is able to share his kavod with others. And that shows you that he is the Melech HaKavod. And indeed, we know that the bracha that's supposed to be recited when encountering a king is Asher Cholak Mikvodo, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu shared essentially his kavod with human beings. And that is a praise of God that he shares his kavod. So the Rashiv expanded that the whole notion of what is genuine and what is false in terms of kavod is that somebody who needs to force others to show him deference and who needs to grab honor and to compel others to show him that type of glory, so that shows you that it's false and that there isn't any substance to it. While someone who really reflects genuine kavod is able to be at peace with it and to radiate that kavod without asking anyone else, demanding anyone else to show that treatment to him in an artificial way, and therefore can also confer it upon others, can also share it. So the whole notion of a Kadosh Baruch Hu as Melech HaKavod is chalek the kavod to his creations, asher chalek mikvodo, that identifies the genuine kind of kavod that humanity can also partake of when they are mevatel themselves to their mission as Ovdei Hashem. And it's the polar opposite of the false kind of kavod that a human being such as Paro would try to grab for himself and try to impose upon others. So that's perhaps the message of what's being conveyed here in this confrontation, and specifically also the language of the Pasuk in using that word specifically is a way of expressing that. And then calling Aaron the Navi is interesting. So many of the Rishonim understand, like the Ramban writes over here, that just like Hashem speaks to the Navi, and then the Navi has the job to convey the message further, so too, that's what's happening here, that Moshe is standing in for Kadosh Baruch Hu. He's the one bringing the message to the prophet, and Aaron is Ki'il the Navi, and he will then take that message and run with it and bring it to the people. And that's the nature of the relationship. And you see that the Rishonim over here, they have different spins on how this pasuk is coming to answer Moshe's question. So when Moshe says, how am I going to go to Paro, and I'm an Arel Sfasayim, is he going to listen to me? And the different interpretations, whether that's one question or two questions, is it because of his lack of success with the Jewish people, or is it because of his being an Arel Sfasayim? So here, what the response contains, that I'm going to be with you and that you are going to be representing my message, and that Aaron's also going to be there and he's going to be the Navi. So the different spins on how exactly this correlates to Moshe's either one or two objections here, and that's something that the Mefarshim talk about. So he continues in this next pasuk to convey this reassurance to him. Ata sedaber eis kol asher atzaveka v'aron achicha yidaber el paro v'shilach es b'nei Yisrael me'artzo. So you will be able to convey all of this, and Aaron will help, and Paro will have to listen and send away the Jewish people. Now, the next pasuk gets a lot of attention, and it's a part of what I was saying before about how this little slice, this brief aliyah, is very reflective of many of the themes in these parshios. So there is a major, major hashkafic issue that is brought up by many of the references in the parshios that we're reading now, and it's highlighted in this pasuk, even though there are many pasukim that provoke this question, but many of them, unfortunately, discuss it specifically here in the context of the pasuk, which provokes that question. So here the pasuk reads, "V'ani aksha es leif paro, v'hir beisi es oso soy, v'es mufsoy beretz Mitzrayim." So I am going to harden the heart of Paro, and the theme really continues into the next psukim. So we'll just read them before commenting. Below Yishma Aleichem Paro, v'nasati es yodibu Mitzrayim, v'hotzeisi es tzivosoi, es tami v'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim, v'shvatim gedolim, and Paro's not going to listen. And I'm going to send my hand in Mitzrayim, and I'm going to take out my nation with these great displays and accomplishments. V'yodu Mitzrayim, k'ani Hashem, b'ntosi es yodi al Mitzrayim, v'otzeisi es b'nei Yishmatochem. And they'll know that I am God, and I stretch out my hand. And here the Mefarshim emphasize stretching out my hand is a way to say that there is a extended message here. It's not just one thing, but it's something that we see reflected over a period of time that stretches out, and that displays that this is meant to sink in and meant to have a very deep impression, and that it should be a lasting redemption. It shouldn't just be that they should change their minds and write right after them, which of course they do, but ultimately the notion that it should be a message that's not just a flash in the pan, but that has a significant impression is a part of the point here. So with all this, so the message seems to be that there's going to be some kind of a external imposition upon Paro's attitude. When God says, I will harden his heart, so it prompts the Hashkafic question, which again is really all over these parashios with many repeated references. But how is that fair? How is that just? That if it is axiomatic that there is Bechira Chavshis, that God creates us with free will, so then how could it be that he could harden anyone's heart? How could it be that anyone could be deprived of their free will and made to do anything? Doesn't that violate a basic instinctive understanding of fairness? And also one of our Ikari Yamuna, that people are free to decide whether to be a tzaddik or a rasha, to do the right thing or to do the wrong thing. How is that legitimate? So here, a lot of the Rishonim address this specifically on this pasuk, and Rashi writes over here to begin with that we see that there's not going to be a change, and in general, these things are not going to change with these types of leaders. So therefore, it's better that there should be a more emphatic process, and that there should be a bigger Kiddush Hashem that comes from this. The Ramban brings up a number of additional approaches, and each one is significant, and they're also echoed in other Rishonim and philosophers. This is not only a question of interpreting Pesukim, but this is a major Hashkafic issue that needs to be defined. So among the answers the Ramban notes is that this is because of what he did already. So it's not that somebody who's innocent can be pushed into an aveira against his will, but somebody who has already earned quite a lot of punishment, so it's a part of justice that it shouldn't be easy for him to just change course on a dime, but it makes sense that he should have to pay a price. It makes sense that there should have to be a furthering along that path so that he should bear the consequences of his initial actions. So that's a part of it. And that's also a broader theme, the notion that tshuva itself and the ability to do tshuva is really a divine gift. So it's one thing to say you have bechira chavshis about what you're going to do in the first place, but once you've already sinned, so the notion that the gates of tshuva should be open in a sense that it's easy for anyone and that there isn't going to be any impediment to that, that's not necessarily just either, especially if someone has sinned in a egregious fashion. So it's a part of justice itself, just like it's just to have free will to begin with, but it's also just that somebody who deserves punishment shouldn't have a easy path to change course. Some emphasize that it's still possible, that it's not completely hidden from him the path to tshuva, but it becomes harder and it becomes something that now he has to overcome. There is an interesting comment in the Sam Derech here, Simchas Zissel Broyd, where he notes to parallel with mitzvos that Rabbi Saul Salanter had commented that the notion of Lefum Tzara Agra, that we have this idea that one is rewarded for the effort that one puts in, and therefore when it comes to mitzvah, if a mitzvah is harder, so then one gets greater schar. So Bishwal said that, let's say you have somebody who at first to do whatever mitzvah it is, or learning or whatever it is very much against his nature, so he has to work very hard to get started. So there's a lot of tzara to get agra for, there's a lot of effort to be rewarded. But then later on, after he's developed a taste for it and a habit for it, so now it's much easier. He does it much more naturally. So one might think, okay, so now he's actually reduced his schar for the mitzvah because now it comes to him in a much more apparent fashion doesn't have to work so hard, so maybe there's no longer that schar. Says no, it all goes back to the initial effort, that because to get to this point he had to work so hard and to push himself to the place where it eventually became more natural and easier for him, so therefore the schar even now is correlated all to that initial effort that was so much more of an uphill battle. So it says here as well, this is the opposite idea, that the onesh that is going to come to Paro is not because of what he does from here on in. It's not because, okay, he's being held responsible for something where he didn't have much of a choice. Initially, he chose to do this with all of the full free will and with everything that can be justly held against him. So therefore, that is the cause of everything that happens from here on in, and therefore all of it traces back to that initial decision to act with evil, and therefore that counts as well. And this is a theme that you also find in the Rambam, in Hilchos Teshuva, in Perek Vav. He discusses these themes along these lines as well, has a similar approach. And the Rambam also discusses that, also quoting from a Medrash, that here we find this language really only after the first five Makos. We find until this that Paro was deciding to harden his heart, was deciding to be firm in the face of all of the pressure. So essentially this is an outgrowth of what he has done to himself. And now Kadosh Baruch Hu is pushing it further along, but it's all because Paro has brought himself to this point. And I think there is an additional element here. It's not just like we were saying a minute ago about to be punished for what you did before, but it's that the free will is also something which you can increase or decrease based on your actions. So, and this is related to a concept that Rav Dessler is well known for discussing about the Nekudas HaBechira, that the point along the spectrum of where our choices lie differs based on our context and the settings that we have created for ourselves and the decisions that we've made. We don't always have the same range of choices. Once we make decisions, we push ourselves along a certain path and the range of our choices change. And here too, it's noteworthy that Paro had continued to nourish a certain side of himself, so now that was being pushed further. But he had many opportunities to decide to make different kinds of decisions, but because of the decisions that he made, so he pushed himself into a further place where there is a much harder situation here now for him to reverse. And I think it's a very important idea also to consider, because especially this week we've seen such egregious and horrifying incidences of people behaving in a terrible way, and it makes you wonder how can a person who's ostensibly coming from a background of Torah mitzvos, how can they act in an evil fashion? And what does that mean about people's yetzaharas and about people's inclinations? And a big part of it is that what you nourish within your tendencies becomes stronger and stronger. So everybody starts out with a yetzahara and a yetzer tov, but somebody who continuously gives into the yetzahara and continuously does actions that strengthen that instinct and that attitude becomes worse and worse, and turns into a person of great evil, because they are continuously making decisions that make that aspect of their innate character much more powerful. And that's a part of what we are seeing here as well. Some of the other Rishonim have a different spin. So for example, the Sfarno writes that the point of saying his heart was hardened, that's not about his morality, it's not about his tshuva. It's not that we're saying that he was stopped from repenting. This is all about his relationship to the Makos, that he should be able to withstand the Makos. And so Sforno notes that you could have had a situation that if he wasn't more strong-willed, so then he could have buckled under the pressure of the Makos, and he would have let the Jews go without tshuva. So about his moral stature, it would have been a whole separate thing. But that wouldn't have helped as far as his Bechira Chavshis and as far as his Chayav Onesh. He would have just let them go because he couldn't stand the pressure anymore. But it wouldn't necessarily mean that this has anything to do about what he's going to be held accountable for. So others have a similar kind of spin, maybe a little bit differently, that this was not about forcing him to be somebody he wasn't. This was actually about allowing his true self to come out, and his true self was bad. But the point was that in order for him to express his full evil here, he had to be able to withstand the makos and not give in to that pressure. So therefore, what God was doing was basically equalizing the playing field, and the makos were for the purpose of Kiddush Hashem and for the purpose of making the statement to the world and to Mitzrayim about God's power in the Jewish people. But as far as the morality and as far as the accountability that Paro had, that's on a whole different track here. That Davka, because he was given the extra fortitude to resist the makos, that was why he was able to continue along this path and to express his actual ratzon. So that's also a very powerful notion. The Oznaim Latorah Liskarev has a comment over there where he compares this to the Rambam's comment about Gittin. The Rambam writes in Mishnah Torah that we know that a get has to be given of free will, and yet the Gemara also says that there are certain times when a get can be compelled. So how can you reconcile the idea that it should be a free will and it should be able to be compelled at the same time? So the Rambam basically writes that the Pintali Yid really wants to do it, but the Yitzhahara is getting in the way. So we have to negate the Yitzhahara, we have to correct for that, and then the real Ratzon comes out. So this is kind of the opposite, that Paro had the Pintala Russia inside him, more than Pintala Russia, and therefore maybe the Amakos could have had the opposite effect. So being able to endure the Makos, having this fortitude that was being imposed upon him, allowed the true Ratzon, his true free will, to express itself. There's also a notion here, which some of the Rishonim have in other contexts, and the Ramban also alludes to, as a pasuk in Mishle, that maybe not everyone has free will. That the notion that it's axiomatic that there's free will, that's for people in general. But when you have a world leader, so then that becomes a problem from other directions to say he has absolute free will, especially relating to his actions that impact the path of history. So if a Kadosh Baruch Hu is directing history and world leaders have such a influence on what happens as far as major world events, so then maybe there has to be, to some degree, a limitation on the free will of the leader, Yilev Melech, Biat Hashem, that the Kadosh Baruch Hu has the ability to be nota the will of a leader in order to, obviously he has the ability, but apparently he has also the readiness to control the heart of the king in order to allow history to unfold in the way that Hashgacha intends. So that's also a discussion here. It's an interesting comment to the Mashiach Chachma. You can take a look that a little bit early, the Meshech Chachma has a comment on Pasuk Chav Tes, that he has a different version of the question we mentioned before. He thought this is the refutation, this is a problem of Moshe's Kal V'chomer, that when Moshe said the Jews didn't listen to me, how could Paro listen to me? So Moshe was saying that the Jews, they're at least individuals, they have free will, and they chose not to listen to me. Paro is a ruler, so maybe he doesn't have full free will, and that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's responses are correlated to that particular objection. You can take a look to see the way he conveys that. It's an unusual approach. The Ksava HaKabbalah has a whole different way of looking at this, and he says maybe it doesn't even mean either of those things. Maybe it doesn't mean that we'll take away his free will, nor does it mean that we will give him the fortitude to resist the makos so his true will can come out. Maybe it just means I'm going to give him a very hard time, that I'm going to pain his heart, as you might say in English. I'm going to give him high blood pressure, going to stress him out so much that he's going to really have a difficult period seeing what's happening here, and that's really going to anguish him, it's really going to stress out his heart. And maybe that's how we should interpret Aksha Slave Paro, and it doesn't necessarily have to contradict the notion of free will. So there's a lot to say, and a lot to understand about these themes. And again, this Aliyah, as brief as it is, really packs into it a lot of the themes of the parsha and a lot of the themes of all these parshios and some of the major themes of how we relate to the world and how we relate to our ability to function as Ovdei Hashem. And just to finish out the Aliyah, the pasuk says, "V'yas Moshe v'Aaron kasher tziva Hashem osam kein asu Moshe ben Shmonim Shana v'Aaron ben Shalosh Shmonim Shana b'Dabrim lo Paro." So just so you should know, so Moshe was 80 and Aaron was 83. And this Nayim Latorah, you can take a look, has a comment over there. Also, you see how people very often by that age they are well into retirement and they are looking to relax and they are looking to do very different things than what Moshe started at that point. And look how inspiring it is what Moshe is willing to do and to take on even at that age. And I will say to you guys also that normally at this point in reading week and involvement in finals and not everyone's feeling well, so people are looking to relax and not so much relax, but not to have shiurim and to focus on their studying and not have any kind of extra things on their schedule. So that I am very appreciative that you took the time out to participate in this parshas here today that wasn't originally on the schedule. And hopefully we should all get tremendous chus from that, whether it's for Refuah Shleima or for Hatzlacha and whatever we're working on, and all of it should be as a merit for each of us and for Klal Yisrael. Yaron, you have a question?
Yeah, what was Rashi Shita in regards to how we answer the question of God taking away Paro's free will?
So it's on the pasuk here. You can see, you know, a lot of these mafarshim, even though this is a theme that comes up throughout these parashios, but a lot of the mafarshim are here on this pasuk. So here Rashi says that since he's already done so much, Paro has already shown what his inclinations are, and it's also known in general that these types of leaders are not interested in changing their ways. So we don't have much expectation that there's going to be tshuva. It's not like we're really cutting off any meaningful possibility of an expression of free will in a redemptive way. So being that that's already what's happening, and there is a advantage for the purposes of Kiddush Hashem and declaring God's glory in the world through these makos and through these osos and mosim, so it makes sense that we should allow the situation to continue along this path further, because there isn't a real meaningful possibility of tshuva that is being cut off, and there is the advantage of an increase in the power of God's message. Okay, so I wish you all